Hello and welcome to the Jazz Jam Podcast. I am your host, Dwayne Gunnels, joined by my co-host, Max Levy. And on today's episode, we're going to be getting into something a little bit different. We got the opportunity to interview Braxton Cook, the fabulous saxophone player, and talk to him a little bit about his life, his journey as a musician, and also get to talk to him about his most recent album, Who Are You When No One Is Watching. It's an awesome interview. We had a lot of fun. We're going to be reviewing that album on the podcast in an upcoming episode. So stay tuned for that. We're super excited. We'll get into the interview here. Max, how'd you feel about getting to talk to Braxton?
I felt so honored to have Braxton Cook on with us. He gave us a lot of great answers. He was really informative, and he talked to us about his upbringing a little bit and his saxophone journey and some of the albums he's done and some of the performers he's played with and people he's learned from and different techniques in terms of practicing and things like that as a musician and as an artist. He was really easy to talk to, and I just feel sort of inspired from the conversation that we had with Braxton Cook.
Yeah, I totally agree. It was so gracious of him to lend us his time, and just very open and honest with his answers. Super easy to talk to and just really enjoyable to get to hear his story. So without further ado, let's get into that interview now. Thanks again for joining us. We're so happy that you've given us your time and super excited to get to talk to you about, you know, your journey as a musician and, you know, the album and kind of the meaning behind the album, the messages, and as well as the music. And so, First of all, we just wanted to ask you about your tour in Europe. We saw you just got back from tour. So how did that go? Any favorite spots, any favorite gigs that you played while you were there?
That was awesome. The whole run was just incredible. It was a good reintroduction to Europe, because I haven't been there since 2019, since before the whole world shut down kind of thing, you know, since COVID. And yeah, like since COVID, COVID's still with us, but it's, yeah, there's that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just there was a period there where I felt like, yeah, I don't know if we're going to get back to the way the world was before the world shut down. And what I mean is more so like, are we going to get back to doing live performances and shows and packed clubs, or is everything going to be remote and virtual performances and stuff like that? So to be back in we did Paris, Milan, London, then Bologna, then Rome, then Warsaw, Poland, and then I went back to Paris. Like, it was like to do that run was just it was incredible, bro. It almost felt like my first time back in Europe, you know what I mean? Because it had been so long, and to some degree, like I said, I thought, who knows if this will ever be back. So I was just like extremely grateful this time around to be performing, to be playing. I had a different band with me than I normally tour with. This was Brian Richburg Jr. on drums, and he tours with like Christian Scott and Donald Harrison still tours with him. Lucas Kadish on guitar, and then Julius Rodriguez, who played keys and some key bass. So a different kind of setup, different group, but felt fun, very fresh. And I think we sold out every room, bro.
That's awesome. Were you doing a lot of music from the album, or what kind of stuff were you doing?
Yeah, pretty very much still touring this record. So like the majority of the set was probably from the album. But you know, I think since this is project number 7, maybe, you know what I mean? Yeah. I don't know, maybe album 3 or 4, but like 7 EPs, projects or whatever I've put out since 2013. I have to do some music from other records. Like I start out the set with, I kind of tell the story, I feel like, through the set of just like my journey, you know, which we'll get into today. But like the first couple of songs of the set start out from like my album Somewhere in Between. Then I play records from No Doubt. And then like third or fourth joint in there, I introduce the new album that we're touring. And then we get into like MB and other records from the new album. And we kind of start to rock out from
That's
there.
That's awesome. Did you have like a particular audience or stop that you really, really dug more than the others, or was it all just one awesome experience?
They were all great, you know what I'm saying? I'm gonna say that they were all awesome. I'll say the jazz clubs that we started the run with, so like Duke Dillon Bar in Paris, then Blue Note Milan, and Ronnie Scott's in London, those were great. It's just that they're 2 shows a night, so it's a little more exhausting having to do like 2 75-minute performances where you know, you go in, you do your thing, and then you come down and like relax for like 45 minutes. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, oh yeah, we got to do it again. So that was a little more draining, I think, than the second half of the tour, which was like all one show a night kind of like venues where people were kind of standing up and like rocking out. Like, so Bologna and Rome and stuff, like those were just like one set. So very different energies. So yeah, it's like I almost want to say like I had a lot of fun in those, like Rome and Bologna, because it was just like people just having a good time standing up and rocking out. But like musically, I feel like we did get to some more interesting things in the first half of the jazz club. So just, I don't know, different. I can't say there's one particular city, but just just two different
Different,
experiences, and they
yeah.
were all really, really great.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Pluto Milano, that was my first time there, and that was awesome. And I'll say that was sick. Good sound in that room. And a really dope crowd. So that was actually up there.
Have one question on that. Do you ever play differently? Of course you play differently in different settings, but
Yes. You're
are
gonna
there
ask.
moments with audiences where you sort of feed off of the energy, and maybe do you call an audible, you call a different tune sometimes that you weren't expecting?
All the time. Yeah. I
Yeah.
have a set list that I'll write out for sure. So everyone is like, in the same ballpark. Because it's not that on this particular run we didn't have a lot of tracks or anything running, but like sometimes, yeah, the drummer needs to know like the next sound, guitarist needs to know like, oh, am I setting up the next song? I need to get in tune real quick because the next one's a duos or whatever. So sometimes like that is super helpful, honestly, yeah, to have that set list. But absolutely, when I'm like playing these jazz rooms and we're like, okay, second set, actually let's do something different. I do that all the time,
Yeah,
like all the
yeah. I feel like
time.
it helps to have, because Max and I played in an organ trio, and it just helps to have the smaller ensemble. You said there's, the guys doing keyboard, bass, and keys. So sometimes it helps to have like just a smaller ensemble, and you can be a little bit more flexible. Yeah.
And yeah, that's what you need to do that. Mike, you know what? Ballad. Nah, it's ballad time.
Yeah,
You know?
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. So we did a lot of those for sure. It was cool. Very fun run. Very fun tour. Yeah.
All right. Well, we kind of had a couple other questions about more about the start of your musical journey when you were coming up outside DC. And I think I've met Paul Carr at least once or twice. I know about
Oh,
him.
wow.
Yeah, I grew up in North Carolina and studied at East Carolina, where Carol DeShiel was teaching at. He used to tour with Bobby Watson, and he was in DC for a long time. So, I just wondered, is there one or two sort of concepts you learned from Paul Carr early on, or what can you say about, more or less the start of your saxophone journey before you went to Juilliard?
Sure. Yeah. Paul was one of the first people that really got me into like learning, like transcribing and learning by ear.
Yep.
I had a teacher before him, and we were definitely studying and practicing out of the Omnibook. But like the first lesson with Paul, I think he gave me a Cannonball Adderley album, and it was like Portrait of Cannonball, I think. And it had Minority on there. And he was like, come back and transcribe the whole thing. And it doesn't have to be next week, but like whenever I see you, be done with it. And he was real curt and like, kind of distant at first, almost like someone that you wanted to like win their approval and affection. You know what I'm saying? It was like a tough love kind of vibe at first, which was funny. Because Tom, I mean, excuse me, because Paul is actually a really, really nice guy, but like at first he just kind of was like, yeah, learn this and don't come back until you got it. Cool. I was like, all right. It took me a couple weeks. I learned the solo, then I learned like the alternate take, and then we started like kind of going from there, just learning by ear. And he would end the session. We play over Ebersolds and improvise a lot. Like our lessons were like very much surrounding improvising and language and transcribing, learning solos, writing out lines, putting them in all 12 keys. And I'd have notebooks just like this, bro. Like I was just on another podcast earlier explaining like I just had books and books of just like lines. And I'd be in class, in calculus, pre-calc or whatever, just not even really paying much attention, but like writing out lines and all 12 keys. And I was just obsessed with that part of the process. Once I got into it, it became like, I don't know, like Sudoku, like transcribing a Cannonball solo. You're like trying to figure out, you maybe can't hear it yet, especially at that age, but you're just like trying to figure these rhythms out, these notes out. And it was like a puzzle, you know, at first. And I was just like kind of really into that, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a huge, always been a huge part of my process. Even like now, I still like transcribe, I learn by ear. And we would end our lessons. He would just put on a random like Jamie Abersold or something. And we just have to play, just play over tunes and tunes I didn't even know. And he would know it and I didn't know it. He's like, just, you know, and he would try and keep, yeah, you know what I mean? It's like a good trainer that's like just kind of keeping you on your toes and putting weight on the bench that's just slightly outside of your reach. And always keeping it there to the point where I never felt like, dang, like, you know, you leave a lesson feeling like, ah, oh, I didn't get that. I didn't get, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
I never really felt like, yo, I smoked that. Like, I got it. He'd always throw something that made me feel like it was right outside of my ability, but still attainable. And that's just a really good coach and a really good, you know, trainer, you know, that he had that ability to do that and assess that with not just me, but hundreds of kids, you know what I'm saying? Paul is just like one of the most prolific educators in all of the Mid-Atlantic area. So very grateful for that year, those years of being under his tutelage and learned a lot, you know, that's completely shaped me. Like everything down to, yeah, like how I play and learn and teach and even run my band. Like we don't have no sheet music on stage kind of thing. You know, it's a very old school thing, even though I
Yeah.
know like, you know, but they're
No,
right. iPads and all types of shit on stage now, but that's not a thing. It's like, let's get into the music, you know?
I think
And
that's the right way to do it.
yeah, it is. It is. You play the music better, you communicate better. Even if you make mistakes, it's just like we're gonna listen and work our way through it.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Was Cannonball your first love, or were there a couple different players you sort of emulated?
Yeah, before Cannonball, it was probably I made my way to Cannonball through like Grover Washington Jr., like horn players on pop records. I used to love Prince as well. Like my little brother Brendan is like a huge Prince fan. But like we grew up with a lot of that in the house. So there's like, you know, he's pulling from James Brown. So there's a lot of funk horn lines and stuff on Housequake. Boom, doom, 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 doom. You know what I mean? And then horn parts and horn solos and stuff that like I just would gravitate towards, and I would remember, you know, as like a 10-year-old or 11-year-old, I'd remember these parts. I'd remember solos like Cameo, Michael Brecker's Cameo, Earth, Wind & Fire, like After the Love Is Gone, is that it? Yeah, that alto solo. Stuff like that. Smooth jazz records that my dad used to love. I used to hear at the barbershop, you know what I'm saying? All of those kind of like entry points, you know, like we're mainly kind of more popping contemporary sounding at first, but then through reading their Wikipedias or just like going into like, okay, so who is Grover Washington and where he come from? And he's like, oh, he's from Philly. Oh, cool. There's this. Oh, he used to play with this artist and check this person out. Who's Kenny Burrell playing guitar with Grover? And then digging into that and then like, oh, Grover wrote Just the Two of Us. Oh, that's fire. He's a songwriter too. You know, like stuff like that. So I would just, yeah, dig into those artists, and eventually I found Cannonball and Bird like at 14, 15 years old, and I became like, yo, obsessed, you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, because
Yeah.
and Cannonball, like, you know, it wasn't like the first Cannonball record I heard was like, you know, his bebop shit even. I think it was Mercy, 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 you know, it was like blues, like
Yeah.
some stuff like that I probably heard in a movie soundtrack, you know. And then eventually grew from there out from the blues playing to like more of the like linear angular bebop stuff, and then I was obsessed.
Yeah, that album Live at the Club, I think is
Live at the
such a
club, bro.
yeah.
Hippadelphia, man. Hippadelphia, dog. Yeah,
That's right.
Cannonball Live is a whole nother level. Cannonball Live
Oh, yeah.
takes it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I love how you talk about wanting to learn more about the players themselves. I feel like that's something we do on the podcast because we're getting into different albums and just learning the stories and the history behind the music, not just listening to the music, but actually understanding where it came from, where the people that made the music came from as well, I think is really awesome.
Yeah, I was always into that. And my brother Brendan, you know, I'm gonna mention him a bunch because we were the two out of the four boys, Brian, my older brother, then me, then Brendan, and then Brody. We the two middle kids. Me and Brendan were like the ones that were in the music the most, and we were also the closest in age. So we were just always piggybacking off each other. And Brendan is we call him little Wikipedia because he would just memorize like that. You know, he'd read something and just remember it. So we would, we very much would be into, the history, the facts surrounding records, when it was recorded, where it was recorded, like that L Club, that the club record, that one, you know, I was like, is that even an actual live record? And it turns out it's like not, you know,
Right.
that they like recorded that in the studio, but added all this extra stuff. And I was like, oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, they
Right.
really, like, you listen to Styx, you think it's like in a club. I thought that shit was like, you know, but it's very, that's
Yep.
very
Fun.
interesting.
Yeah.
In the liner notes, but like you'd have to like look into it or read it or buy the vinyl.
Yeah, at face
Yeah.
value, it might just appear to be like a live recording in a club. Yeah, I had another question about kind of your journey, and I read that at first you went to study English and African American studies, and then decided to transfer to Juilliard. What kind of drove you to want to study something other than music, and then what made you want to transfer and then go into pursuing music more?
Sure. Yeah. So a lot of that is due to just the household I grew up in. My father is a law professor. He's been teaching civil rights law, constitutional law, for a long time. You know, like he got that job at Georgetown, which is why my family moved to Maryland, D.C. in '91. Excuse me. That's when he started, and that's and then I, you know, we grew up there, and we kind of were very much a Hoya kind of a family. But way before that, also just I think for that generation, particularly of like just, you know, Black Americans, like education is a way out of your circumstances. My family's from like rural Mississippi in Magnolia, Mississippi. I'm heading there actually soon, a couple, in like a week or so. I'm gonna go celebrate my grandma's 90th birthday. But yeah, no, we're from, that's where our family's from. Both my parents were like high school sweethearts. They're from a very small town. And they go back to like elementary school type shit.
Wow.
Like, and made their way to, they both went to Princeton, you know, one of the first people I think in this late 70s to do that from that area. And then when got married, my dad followed, you know, continued to follow on in his kind of like educational pursuits, where he went on to like what, Yale, then Harvard Divinity. It's a very decorated, you know what I mean, professor and educator and brilliant mind. And with that, that laid a foundation in our household that like political social conversations, you know, backed by just like knowledge and text and all of this is very important. Academia has always just been part of what our family is about, and we've been having deep conversations as long as I can remember about, you know, race, politics, and all of these things, and how music, you know, it runs in tandem to that. So I've always kind of had that perspective, if that makes sense. You know,
Yeah.
I didn't grow up like two musicians as parents, but more so like educators in academics, you know, that also are very talented and love music. Like my dad sings and my mom is a great pianist,
Wow.
but that's not what they pursued. And maybe, you know, for all types of reasons, in the 60s, it's not, maybe that they didn't think they could do it. Maybe they thought like, you know, education is my way to getting to where I need to be, all types of things. But I know all of that is very much why I felt conflicted when I finished high school and trying to figure out like, am I going to go straight into music school? And I got into MSM and on and New School and all these other music schools, and some other schools, some schools were like completely free as well. But yeah, you know, you're your dad's son, and you just feel like there were a lot of pressures. I feel like at the time, I felt like Georgetown was maybe the move for now. And then while I was there, I realized, or when I enrolled, I was like, you know, there's no music major, there's no performance major, I should say. There was like a, at the time, ethnomusicology, maybe. Some things tangential to music, and that was cool, but I wasn't really into it. So I just took some of those courses as electives, and I decided, my older brother was an English major, so I was undecided, to be fair, for 2 years. And then I just said, all right, English, I'll take an African American studies, you know, focus. I would have majored in it if they had even had that as an option at the time in 20 or in 09, but they didn't. So I just kind of decided to read text about artists and writers and brilliant people that all helped to inspire a lot of the records that I loved, like James Baldwin, you know, Maya Angelou, and Ralph Ellison, and August Wilson, all of these incredible writers and playwrights, and you know, that helped to, you know, push our people forward, really. I wanted to know more about that, but also know, like, you know, Coltrane and Ellington and these people, they used to hang out with some of these writers, and like there was a synergy there in the Harlem Renaissance of all of these minds and artists, where they just kind of cross collaborate all these different ideas, and or rather pollinated rather, and inspired each other to do different things and create different things. So I was like, let me read and study more about that and get more into that space. It only enriched the music that I end up playing when I start to study Billy Strayhorn and Duke Ellington like full time and stuff. Like I'll have a better, understanding of the context surrounding like Black, Brown, and Beige, or the suite that like one of the first like integrated performances and suites that I think Duke Ellington ever did. Stuff like that. Some of these monumental moments, politically and socially, that also happen to coincide with beautiful musical moments are just like really dope and really amazing to me. So that's what I decided to do during that time. Gave it 2 years. I spent all that time at Georgetown, like I said, like writing out notes, lines, and all this stuff. I was like, I did fine. School's always been very easy for me. So we've always all had good grades. My dad doesn't accept, they're not gonna accept nothing lower than a certain. That's just what it is. So I've always kind of learned how to, juggle, get my A's, B's, and keep it moving. But I really fell in love. I was really just playing so much in DC. To the point where, I was missing, skipping class a bit, and I was out. I was out every night, damn near, going to jam sessions. I started getting weekly gigs in DuPont Circle in D.C., and like the Industry Lounge. So then I started running jam sessions, HR 57, Twins Jazz, all throughout, and still kind of dip going back and hanging with Paul Carr and other students in Maryland. And there did become a point at which I think I was like, all right, I'm ready for something else. And it was right at that point, right around now, in March of like 2010, one of my friends, Josh Crumbly, and Samora Penderhughes and Luke Salenza, all of them, we did Young Arts and Grammy Band and all this stuff back in high school. So they had all gone on to Juilliard right out of high school. And they gave me a call on my birthday, which is March 27th coming up. And they gave me a call, played Happy Birthday. And they're like, bro, you should transfer, man. We miss you, bro. Come to New York, bro. Come to New York. I thought they were just saying that. I was like, really? They're like, no, for real. I think the Anderson Twins just graduated. Eddie Barbash left. Like, I don't know if there's any alto players. It's just Jordan Patay. They were like, bro, you should apply. I think it's some. And turns out they were right. I do feel like it was maybe the most perfect time to apply. In that, I think they kind of were, the program's so small that like there are times where like the graduate students and the undergrads will graduate at the same time, and it'll be a bit of a opening on certain instruments, so there was that year where I was like, you know what, that's true, there's really only like one or two alto players there. So anyways, I'm like, all right, man, I'm gonna do it, I'll apply. I told my parents, I'm like, look, I'm gonna do the thing. I do the pre-screening CD, I do all that. I get in. And then when I get past like that first audition where I'm like, they say they want me to come into the live audition, my parents were like, yeah, man, go for it. Like, do it. They were completely in support of it, which I was surprised, but like I appreciate it. I think they could tell, like, okay, Brax is like, this is what he wants to do. But more importantly than that, after the audition, went well and I got in, then we had a conversation about the financial aid and that aspect. So I have a meeting with, at the time, Laurie Carter, Carl Allen, the dean, everybody, and they're trying to figure out what do we need to come to be able to make this transition. And they're essentially was like, whatever Georgetown is covering, we'll have to match it, And I was like, wow. And that was the game changer right there. But otherwise, yeah, it probably wouldn't have happened. Probably would have just stayed my ass in DC. But that right there, like, yeah, deciding to go to Georgetown, having that tuition benefit. Like, I don't know if I mentioned that before. My bad if I missed that. As a professor, my dad, part of his just package there is like, as a professor, a tenured professor, he's like, his children get free tuition at Georgetown, not just the law school, but like the undergrad as well, And those benefits from the 90s, I don't even know if they give that stuff out like anymore, you know
I
what I mean?
doubt it.
Yeah.
I doubt it.
No, I don't think they do that anymore. They used to just be like, yeah, please, here, and a house, and this, and this. Now, yeah, nah. Yeah, because my wife's a professor, and it's like, nah, it's not, it ain't that, it ain't like that easy. But also, you have to be, you know, he had leverage. So it is what it is. That was the deal locked in, which is great. So my older brother went, I went, and then Georgetown matched that. I mean, Juilliard matched that free tuition, covered it. I was like, yo, this is a sign. This is what I was supposed to do, you know?
Yep.
A bit of a dream deferred, I guess, in my head at the time, but like it was actually perfect timing, and set me up. So then I transferred in 2011. Bro, yeah, didn't really look back. You know what I'm saying? It's just been, I can't say smooth sailing. It's been crazy.
Yeah.
But I love it. You know what I mean? Like, I've had a beautiful, incredible life in music so thus far.
Yeah, and
But
I
yeah.
think that's just it's such a relatable thing for so many young musicians because I know so many people feel that societal pressure to go to college and, you know, do this and get a degree, and just to hear your story and your journey from feeling that pressure and having parents who want you to be successful and, you know, expect things from you, but then, you know, realizing how much you're in love with playing and just getting through, you know, getting through the scene in DC and just being able to be like, no, this is what I'm gonna do, and if I'm passionate about it, it's gonna work out. So I think people hearing that, you know, might inspire them to realize that, like, if you're passionate about something, you can make it happen.
That's it.
And I would say there was some divine intervention with that phone call, because that's what brought you there, and that started everything else, you know?
Bro, it's been a lot of that my entire life, if we really talk about it. Like, where God just, you know, just and gives me just the clarity, you know, in these junctures, you know, yeah, it's happened in the pandemic. It's happened before, like with my having a family. It's like, yeah, there've been these junctures in my life where you're at a crossroads and like, I can go this way or I can go this way, you know, red pill, blue pill almost. And someone's like, makes it very abundantly clear, like, no. You know,
Yeah, there you go.
night I
That's
met
it.
Christian Scott, same thing. And interestingly enough, a lot of this goes back to the same group of friends, you know. This experience I had with the Grammy band, you know, I don't know if y'all are even familiar with what that was, but it's this conglomerate, this group of musicians selected all over the country. And at the time, we were all invited out to go do a big band performance out in LA and then go visit the Grammys. It was at the time maybe sponsored by Baldwin and the Grammy Foundation, and they've sponsors have been changing in and out. I don't even know if it exists anymore, this program. But this is where I got to meet, weirdly enough, some of the most some of the all these people. There's so many people still working right now, I should say, in jazz, that like we all were in the same group. It's like Benny Bonack, Emmett Cohen, shoot, Willie Nice Wonger, Brian Carter, who just got a couple Emmys or something. Joshua Crumbly, like I said, Corey Fonville, who played drums. Jeez, I'm missing people. Lauren Desberg used to sing, and oh yeah, Michael Mayo, Jasmiya Horn, Ben Lusher, who was Third Story. Ooh, I mean, the list is it's wild. And this is just in a 2 year period. If I like open it up to like, yeah, it's wild. The people that have done this. So in that small group of musicians, yeah, a few of them went to Juilliard and they gave me a call. And then the same thing happened. The trombonist Tyler Ginsberg, who played in Grammy Band, who's happened to be from New Orleans the night I met Christian Scott, my first year in New York at Juilliard, is like, yo, Donald Harrison has a show, Symphony Space. You want to go? Got a couple tickets. I left them at will call. Pull up. I was like, really? All right, I'll go. I'll do it. One of those. I'm not doing anything. I was just gonna practice tonight, sure. You know, pack up my horn and I go uptown. I didn't have money for the train. So I might have hiked the train or I might have just walked. I might have walked from 60 something to 96. Wasn't that far. So I get to Symphony Space, boom, tickets and will call. Just like you said, show it kind of just started. I get the ticket. I'm like, cool. I go find Tyler and all them, and they're all New Orleans homies. And like we go and chill. We're just like catching up, like whispering and stuff, kind of catch up in the seats and like watching the show. And they crushed it. And then halfway through the show, Christian Scott comes out. Wasn't even that familiar with Christian that much, but all I know, he came out decked out in this all gray, like Christian Dior. It was fly. And he just crushes it. Man, yo, this guy right here is like, I don't know who this cat is, but Christian is, whoa, whoa. Sound, you know, what a massive sound, looked super cool, super fly. Couldn't believe it. And of course, Donald crushes it. Like, Donald Harrison sounded incredible. it was just like a really special night, you know?
Yeah.
And what? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I know Dwayne and I have checked out Stretch Music, and I know you were on a track or two. What's it like working with Christian Scott, it kind of in the moment on a record or on a gig or something? Is there
Oh, it's
something?
incredible, bro.
Yeah.
Incredible. I'll get there. I'll get there. So,
okay.
So I'm hanging. I'm still up in the seats. The show's over. They go, bro, I known Christian since I was a kid, man. Let's go backstage. I was like, you sure? He's like, yeah, bro, we're good. Let's go. We go backstage. I go up to Donald Harris. That was an incredible show, sir. It's a pleasure to meet you. I'm Braxton, blah, blah, blah. Explain who I was. I'm like a jazz student over at Juilliard. Oh, cool. Yeah. Nice to meet you. You know, it's just real chill. And then we go over to Christian, and they're all like, you know, surrounding Christian, gassing him up. And then they like start, they're like, yo, this dude Braxton. I didn't introduce myself or anything, but they just start gassing me, bro. They're like, oh, he's ridiculous. He's the truth. But I'm telling you, you gotta hear him. You gotta hear him. Like, yo, guys, chill, bro, chill. And then Christian's like, oh, word? Okay. So we start talking. I'm like, yo, my family's from Mississippi. Oh, word, my family's from New Orleans. They're like we started talking about that. And then eventually we exchange information into the night. He's like, bro, I'm gonna call you for some stuff. Months go by. I don't hear anything. Then suddenly he calls me. He's like, bro, you free for this TV show? Like, you gotta come do this. It's called The Eddie. We're doing a pilot. Come to LA, you know, and shoot this thing. I was like, fine, I'm down. So I go out and do it. My dad's like, yeah, go for it. Cause I'm just like, I'm back in Maryland. First summer after freshman year, I'm back in Maryland chilling. My dad says, yeah, go for it. I fly out to LA, we shoot, we tape. And he gives me all the solos and I'm like, just playing, you know? And Christian just starts like complimenting me, bro. And then he's just like, yo, you sound good, man. You want to come sit in with us at the Blue Note? It's like, sure. When is it? August. I'm like, cool. Let's do it. It's like the next month. So then I go to, I'm getting ready for that gig. I'm back in Maryland learning the music. And then I'm like, yo, so what do you want me to play? Like, what harmony parts? He's like, just make them up, bro. I'm like, oh, okay. I was like, there are a few harmony parts on guitar, but there's no other, like, and he's like, just play what you feel. I was like, okay. This is crazy. I don't know what you want me to play, but fine. So I just make up some parts, learn the whole double record, pull up to the Blue Note. And this is the old band, Jamire, Chris Fun, and Lawrence, and Matt Stevens. And I sit in, and bro, like, he was like, yo, I think you sound great. You know, he was just like, I think you're in the band, my bro, little bro, kind of thing. He was on that. I was like, whoa. Then he sent me a bunch of tour dates, bro. Like fall of 2012, and that was the beginning of like joining the group, you know, one of those. And like you said, to Stretch Music, to skip ahead a bit to 2015, like, yeah, man, playing in Christian's group, like, particularly while I was in school, it kept me like focused, it kept me inspired, it kept me like still in this thing. Because to be fair, I was dealing with some burnout, I think, while I was in school. Just playing there, studying there, that environment. It just didn't feel like real in the sense that like, yeah, you're in school, you just kind of create your own, your students start to create your own barometer of like what's good, what's like, what's whatever, you know? And it gets a little clicky and a little interesting. But like having a gig outside of school like that with Christian, with like real fans, people that buy tickets, people that want to come check you out, people that are just having a good time, it just reinvigorates that there's something after all this, you know. It just gave me that, like, you know what I'm saying, that thing to push forward to while I was in school, because you can get so stuck and caught up in the minutia, and particularly in a program like that, it'll just burn you out, you know. And I was dealing with that second, third year, so like, I'm very grateful that I had, as hard as it was juggling the two, because that brought on difficulties in and of itself, missing class and all types of stuff, having to redo all ear training and get tutors. And there was a lot, but I think had I not had that, who knows? Because I was like, that really inspired me, you know, like to be able to like leave class on Friday and get on the plane and go do a show in like St. Louis or somewhere, Seattle with Christian, and like, a sold out room and people just loving it. And like, it was inspiring, you know what I'm saying? It was like, I got to feel like, it felt like a postgraduate studies or some shit, you know what I'm saying? Or like my internship had already started while I was in school, kind of thing. And it really helped to shape kind of like what it is I wanted to do and what it is I didn't want to do. You know what I'm saying? And
Yeah.
what it is I sound like, and what it is I didn't want to sound like, and all types of things, you know, that I would glean and pull from different artists while I was on the road, and different like we do festivals, and just I get to check out other shows and during the summer, you know what I mean? And just learning. It was a lot that I learned from Christian.
Yeah.
That thing about school versus, you know, real life gigging, that goes back to Miles Davis when he was at Juilliard for a little bit. And, you know,
Oh.
you read about that and his real life experiences with Bird and all that sort of thing.
Oh yeah, how crazy that was. Yeah, hanging with Bird and like, yeah, and how young Miles was. Those stories are crazy. But that's true. That's true. You grow up quick a little bit, you know, on the road. You grow up quick. But like I should say, just like, you know, in the sense, I was 21 and everyone's like having a good time and drinking or whatever. We're all adults, but when you know what I'm saying, like the lifestyle of just like touring and traveling versus like a conservatory, like, you know, school environment, completely different. So yeah, very grateful for that. Very grateful for those experiences because it's like that's the learning they can't teach you. That's the part education that you can't learn. And while in school. So I'm just very fortunate to have gotten that almost in tandem at the same time to know like, okay, these are the rules, and then this is how we break the rules, but this is the but the audience loves it. So it's like I started to understand kind of how all this functions and like kind of, you know what I mean? Like yeah, what to really sit with and what I need to study, you know, and then like how to implement it. And so I was kind of getting that flow while I was in school and seeing that, and that was cool. And also just seeing Christian's honesty and like artistry and that difference as well as like being a technician and an artisan and knowing so how to do and play almost anything in any style on your instrument, and then how that correlates to. Or maybe doesn't, but how that kind of relates to like being an artist though, and like having a very clear and cl clear perspective on things, politically, socially, artistically, sonically, all those different things. Like, oh, you know what I mean? I was like, oh yeah, he's got his thing. Like, this is like the point he wants people to walk away from the show. Like, this is what he wants people to feel. This is what he wants people to think. This is like, you know, these are his stances on certain things, and I saw that. I was like, oh yeah, cool. And that, and him and Rob Glasper also had the same manager, so we do a lot of double bills where I see Rob and I'm like, oh, Rob is actually really funny. He's like on the mic and shit, and like, you know what I mean, like just seeing like different personalities but ultimately people being who they are and find connection with different audiences or the same audiences. And just seeing that, I was like, okay, this is more so about, yeah, finding who you are and, you know, really expressing that the best way that you can. And that was really cool to see as well.
Yeah.
You know,
And it sounds
like,
like there was a lot of trust that Christian put in you from the very beginning and just kind of let you figure it out for yourself, you know, versus being at Juilliard and maybe having a much more regimented way that you're thinking about things. And he's just like, yeah, go ahead and get it and let you figure it out for yourself. So that seems like it was super helpful.
very much was like that. You know, Christian is a particular guy with certain things, but not with that. He'd be like, yeah, wear whatever you want. Do you let me just let me play. It was cool. It was a lot of that. It was a lot of that. It was cool.
Well, do we want to have some questions about the album?
Yeah, I had a couple more just random general questions. They're just kind of like quick questions. Max and I talk about pet peeves sometimes when it comes to being musicians or being on gigs. Are there any pet peeves that you have as a musician or like when you're gigging?
Sure. I just had one in Milan. Like someone just talking so ridiculously loud. I damn near had to curse somebody out. I was like, yo, I'm gonna need y'all over there to shut the fuck up. My
Yeah.
bad.
Oh, you're good. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I was just like, that was crazy. It's like in the middle of a cadenza or something, or I don't know what it was. I was just like, yo, that's wild. Then the audience clapped. They were like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Cause I was like, is anyone gonna say something? That's insane. Yeah,
Yeah.
so that's a pet peeve.
Yeah,
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah.
and particularly in that like chill jazz environment. I guess when everyone's sitting down eating and it's quiet, like, yeah. Now when I play like the bar gigs and we're all like everyone's having a good time and I'm like, no, that's a different thing. I'm not just trying to get people to be silent at like the rock club where like we're all up rocking out. But like when it's at dinner, chill, kind of vibe, and you're the only one. I'm like, yeah, you're drunk. Like,
Yeah.
stop.
Lack of
So,
awareness.
yeah. That. Let's see. That's one. Another pet peeve. When they just like in general, when it comes to touring.
Yeah, anything. Yeah.
Oh man, I have so many.
Go for it. Yeah, you're good.
I was just telling my manager, I was like, bro, because I had to sing, I was like, please don't do multiple interviews or schedule hella interviews on the same day.
Yeah.
We have to, like, I feel like there's only so many miles my voice can like deal with as far as steps and just like words, I should say. Like, I can't talk all day and then go do two sets, you know, and
Yeah.
expect to retain my, like, still have a vocal cords or be able to sing, you know what I mean? And then the next day do it again, then the next day do, I'm like, nah, not for me. So that's annoying. Let's see. Woo. Non-direct flights. Sure. Those are hella.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one that Max and I have talked about, and we'll do this like week to week on the podcast, if something happens on a gig and one of us are like, yo, the most annoying thing happened. One thing is like people asking, like requesting songs that have nothing to do with what you're doing. That can be annoying. If you're playing like a more society gig and like they're like asking you to play at a level that's like less than the radio, like that's another annoying one for us. So yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we dealt with the other side of that, like the where like our music, we needed some 808 and shit to like not, bro.
Yeah.
And I think the first three cities or the venues rather, because they were the jazz clubs, were just like, we have like there were like sound ordinances they were saying, or like we have a limiter and we can't turn this up so much, or the whole thing will turn off. I'm like, dang, or the cops will, like we kept hearing stuff like that, or I was like, that's unfortunate, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because
Oh,
like
yeah.
that, so stuff like that where like I don't know, I don't even know if it's out of our control or if it's just that's just what they're telling us because they just would rather not rock the boat. But that affects the sound of the music and it affects the impact of the sound and to the audience, and that's annoying. Yeah, bro, hella shit. I got a long list.
I feel like all have dealt with that kind of the loud thing and yeah, people being annoying about that. I had another question. I was gonna ask, are there any recent albums or artists that you've really been digging lately?
Sure. Yeah, Jordan Ward's album is fire.
Yep.
Yeah, Forward. That was called?
Yep.
Or more. Yeah.
Forward.
Next one, Forward, I think.
Yeah.
That shit's hard, whatever that one is. Yeah, who was it? I listened to Brent's new record. Brent Faiyaz's
Okay.
most recent, I should say. Fire. Who else I've been listening to? Like new. Who dropped some new heat? Oh, Victoria Monet's joint. Yeah, a lot of R&B stuff, I guess.
Cool.
Like,
Yeah.
yeah, wasn't doing to a lot of that
Awesome.
new stuff. I haven't heard much, even though I know that people have dropped. I'd be lying if I told you I listened to like anything that's that new. Yeah, that's about
Cool.
it. I've been listening to, new R&B
Cool. Yeah,
records.
it's awesome. Yeah, I just wanted to get a feel for what you have been listening to. And then my last one before we get into the questions more about the album is if you could assemble a group of musicians from the past to do either a recording or play like a live show with, who would you want to have on the gig or on the recording with you?
Whoa. That's a
I
hard question,
know.
Dwayne.
I
Jeez.
know.
That's insane, bro.
Anyone, you can
Yeah,
pick
man.
anyone.
Well, bro, it's probably gonna be some version of Miles's group. You know what I'm
Yeah.
saying? I'm gonna make a super group of both quintets.
Right, yeah.
Double bass, double drums,
Nice.
Cannonball, Coltrane, and Sonny Rollins. And we're all just gonna trade out on different songs. That's what I'm gonna do.
Bring them all in. That's awesome.
Well, Oscar Peterson used to play with two bass players sometimes.
Yep.
So,
That's true.
it's
Yeah,
in there.
depending on like what the tune calls for, some more modern shit will get Rod on there.
Hell yeah.
Some more stuff I'll put Paul Chambers. Yeah, stuff like something like that. I don't know. That's so difficult. And I'm just saying that because like I've been listening to Miles Davis like live at the Newport, like that collection. The first record is like, the Philly Joe group and
Yeah.
or rather Jimmy Cobb, and then the other one is the next quintet. So I'm like, that's kind of just been like, top of mind. So like that's probably my choice for now. That's a crazy question.
Yeah,
Any
so
bottom thoughts?
yeah, sorry to spring that on you.
That's tough.
Yeah, Max, you want to get into the album question, start talking a little bit more about that.
Sure. Yeah, I just have sort of a general question about it. We've touched on it a little bit. We've talked about like family, divine intervention, that sort of thing. That seems to be somewhat of the messaging of your newest, latest record, Who Are You When No One Is Watching? Is there a specific experience or belief system or something you're basing some of the titles on, or is it just life's experiences and your family? Was there
Right.
like a particular inspiration that brought on this messaging with this album?
Well, just life has really been the main, my inspiration is for most of my albums, to be fair, are just my life and lived experiences, I think of most of my records as like just snapshots of where I'm at a certain point in time. And this over this past like 3, 4 year period, I've transitioned to moving across country to LA from New York to LA, starting a family. Married since my last album. So it's like, so many huge pivotal life moments have happened that they've all affected me in a lot of ways. And it took years to really process that and for it to kind of manifest in song form. So a lot of this album is really just about that transition and my stepping into parenthood, fatherhood, leaning on my own parents for guidance and understanding on that process as well. So a lot of those conversations are kind of peppered throughout the album. And I say to your, but I think you were almost getting that. Was there something that like inspired it? I mean, Christianity and like and being raised, Christian also is very much part of my upbringing and my understanding of life, and humanity and afterwards. So, that song, that interlude Faith is very much based on, that idea. And I feel like you can feel that in my music. There's a gospel kind of spiritual element in a lot of my playing and a lot of my, so like, yeah, that's a sound I grew up on and listened to. And yeah, I was raised very, like I said, raised Christian, raised Baptist to be specific. So yeah.
Great answer. Also, a couple of the songs you touched on it a little bit that you're into R&B, and there's some serious R&B
Oh yeah, sure.
influences in the album and some of the stuff you're doing. I didn't know, are there a particular, couple of artists, maybe Frank Ocean or something, or someone else that really inspires you to combine jazz with R&B like the way that you do?
Yeah, I mean, the way that I do it, I'm very much inspired by Aramaj, Jeremiah's first group, Jeremiah Williams' first project or something. I don't know if that was the name of, yeah, I think that was the name of the group, Aramaj. It's just his name spelled backwards. He put an album out in 2012 called Conflict of a Man, and that shit was incredible. And that inspired like the sound, I think, for Somewhere in Between, And then also everyone in the group, in my own band, you know what I mean? Like all my friends helped to contribute to the sound as well. But it's like some of it is like we've all got similar influences, and we all love Jamar playing, so it's like that makes sense. Me and Fro, we both love Coltrane, so it's like we play similar kind of things, or like we're coming out of that bag. Tabor and Matisse that just have this like deep like love for, like, in addition obviously to the tradition, but like funk and like Earth, Wind & Fire is like Matisse's favorite group, and then like and D'Angelo, and then Tabor, he can probably play any Michael McDonald song or like George Duke, or you know what I mean? Like, do you know what I'm saying? So like all their influences make their way into it, but it's like that's because we're friends, you know what I'm saying? And we wouldn't have been friends had we not all liked the same stuff. Cause I love George Duke too, and I love Earth, Wind & Fire too, you know what I'm saying? And you know what I mean? Like, so those kind of conversations start early. They started in the dorm room, you know what I'm saying? Like, bro, you know this song? Yeah, man, I love Earth, Wind & Fire. And then we just start jamming on it and stuff. And like over time, you start to get to know these people, you know, it's like deeper than, you know, their musical influence and almost what they're going to play and what they're going to bring. And when there's synergy there, it just, it makes the whole greater than it ever could have been by me just making this completely by myself in my room type thing, you know? Mm. So, I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful to be born when I was born. I'm grateful to have met them when I met them. You know what I'm saying? Like, so much had to be right, I think, for this to be captured in that kind of way.
Yeah. One part of the album that I really like are the journal entries that you have throughout the album. And yeah, they do such a great job of giving us insight and perspective into your life. Mm-hmm. At what point in like curating, creating the album, did you decide that like you wanted to include these short journal entries?
Honestly, it was near the end, you know, mm-hmm. Near the end of, after I recorded a lot of it, mixed a lot of it, I was like, you know, I want this to be kind of chronicle. I want this record to kind of chronicle the conversations and the journey that I went through, like in therapy over the past few years, where I really started to like work on just like myself, some past trauma shit, just all the stresses and anxieties that came with the pandemic, just unpacking all of that and working through that. Some of that work required conversations with my parents, to be honest, like that's what it was. So, you know, with their permission, I was like, guys, I think this has been a huge part of this creative process, you know, and I, you know, would love to share some of these conversations if that's cool. And they were like, yeah, you know, go for it, you know. And so I kind of just layered it, or scored it rather, with like some beats and ideas that I was making and sharing on Instagram and stuff through the pandemic. And I was like, oh yeah, this sounds nice under this. And I tried different beats out and ideas under different conversations and different start and end points, and eventually just found something that felt natural. And that was it. Yeah.
Yeah. So those were real life conversations that you had with your mm-hmm. dad. Nice.
Yeah. Very long conversation, hours, you know, very long. Just sitting in my Logic. I still have so much of it that I, you know, but I'm gonna cherish that shit forever. You know, it's like, we had some really dope conversations that we hadn't had.
Mm. Yeah.
And that was during the pandemic?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It feels so vulnerable, and it feels like it just lets us like get to know you really well and like into your life a little bit. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, man. Appreciate that. To answer your last question, which I completely just like, I said, with another one. My favorite like singers now, like, bro, yeah, Frank obviously, but like I love Miguel. I think he's like got a really great tone, bro.
Yeah.
And it's just yeah, I like that his range is fire, man. Yeah, Lucky Day is fire. That man, yeah. Like, bro, he could sing, bro. Yes. Jasmine Sullivan, another one. Goat.
Oh yeah.
Can sing soft. Shoot, yeah. I mean, Alex Isley, beautiful tone. I love PJ Morton.
Yeah.
I love these cats. Like they're great. Yeah. Really soulful.
Crazy. I love PJ as well. Gumbo's an iconic album. That album is just so good. Do you listen to any Daniel Caesar at all? I feel like there's a little bit of that kind of feel.
Yes, he got quiet, so I haven't heard about him and I haven't mentioned him in a while, but
yeah.
Yeah, he was a big reason why I started singing at the time. Yeah, he just seemed like someone around my age group, very chill, like, voice. He also, you know, I've always liked John Mayer. He seemed like kind of influenced by him a bit. It was like John Mayer, but don't look nothing like John Mayer kind of thing. And that was cool to see, you know, no, for real, like a black kid, like, guitar, like nice voice, really good songs, you know?
Yep.
Emily King, I love that. Same kind of thing. Just beautiful tone, great voice. Yeah, some of those like crooners, I would call them. Like, you know what I'm saying? They're like not belting and going crazy, but like great songwriters, beautiful voices and nice tones. And, like,
yeah.
I love that. I do.
Yeah, yeah. And it comes through. It's, yeah, just easy to listen to. Like,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask, were there certain emotions that you were trying to elicit throughout points of the album? Or was it more about like the message and just your perspective on life?
Sure, yeah. The message is definitely important. It's all like MB, like that's yeah, one of those. But you want the message and the emotion to kind of, you want them to intersect and kind of meet. So that one, like even sonically, I wanted it to knock like pretty hard. I wanted to have some low end. I wanted it to have like there's some delayed effects in there that even sounds like an ambulance symbol, like in there somewhere. That's like a bit of urgency. So, you know, I wanted some of the songs definitely to elicit an emotion that matched the message and had the same kind of urgency to it. I wanted Gold to have that really vulnerable and emotional, kind of sad feeling, melancholic a bit, you know, because that song is a complex tune about just like the some of the issues in my parents' relationship, all while I'm stepping into the next phase of mine as a parent and wanting to do the things that I feel are necessary to keep a relationship happy and strong. You know, that's a complex feeling and it feels that way. And it's mixed that way. I added all these other sounds and instruments, and then I'm like, we just started stripping things away and just kind of keeping it bare, most of it, you know, just to let it breathe in that space, like let it be there. It's one of those. So yeah, I mean, I guess to answer your question, most of the songs in the writing process, I'm thinking emotion first. Even when I pick up my instrument, like, what am I trying to emote? What am I trying to say? You know? Yeah, this a happy kind of song? Is this a sad song? Like, you know what I mean? And is this a love song? Like, do I like what am I trying to say? What do I want people to feel? What do I feel? You know, and that's first and foremost. So that comes like in the creation of the song itself. And then of course, yeah, as I start to like record it and then add production, like it's all about just amplifying that, you know, and highlighting those things, or you know, artistically doing the opposite. If I want, I have, you know, there's sad songs that have a bop to it. You know what I mean? And we make those kind of creative choices in post sometimes.
Yeah, that's a great answer.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like it's easier to, because you know, you talked about singing and also playing the sax. Do you feel like it's easier to express yourself through like the more instrumental jazz tracks and playing the saxophone on the album, or the singing the more lyrically driven R&B tracks? And how is it different trying to express yourself in the two different ways?
Oh, it's really for me, it's as simple as like I think the saxophone I can just play much more powerfully and like so like I just use that in the spectrum of like even the set, you know, I'll sing the ballad a lot of the times because my voice is gonna cater itself to that, just as a softer tone, you know what I'm saying? Just that's what I'm born with, you know what I mean? It's so I'm like kind of like I use my voice where I feel like I can get the point across, and it's typically on like the chiller, like love songs, and then like the ballads, and then like a tune like MB. It's like I'm not gonna sing that. I'm not gonna scat that. You know what I mean? Even scat it when I wrote it. You know, da da da, but da, da, da. I probably did scat it when I made it, but there are songs where I'm like, no, I know to get this point across with the urgency and kind of like thing it needs, like the horn is going to do that. That's the instrument that's going to best get that point across. You know what I'm saying? I've always known that since like somewhere in between, like it's kind of how
Just
I,
comes naturally, yeah.
yeah, exactly. I'll sing the ballad, sing the chill song, play the ones that go harder.
As a sax player, is
Mm-hmm.
there anything you did to work on your voice? Did you sing solos? Was there some coaching you had or
Sure, yeah. I've done some musical theater back in the day. We sang in church, singing at home all the time. And then, yeah, I mean, I'm sure if anything, I feel like just having played the saxophone at this level, it does make singing a bit frustrating because you just like, I'd be like, dang,
Right.
I can hear the shit, but I can't do what I'm hearing. So that shit is frustrating sometimes, to be fair. But yeah, I'm sure it helps. I'm sure it helps with like all types of things, harmony, pitch, all. I know what to do, but then it's just a matter of reps, man. And that's, you know. Like in high school, I practiced 8 hours a day during the summers, you know? Yeah, 2 hours on like sound and overtones and stuff, 2 hours scales and chords, and then 2 hours like just improv over Ebersolds and stuff. And then like probably another 2 hours somewhere in there of just listening and transcribing, and I used to just go online, find solos, and play along to them. So like, I would go, yeah, that was it. You know,
Yeah.
like there's no way around that. So I probably, yeah, have I practiced singing as much as I practice saxophone? Probably not. So like, I need to, yeah, just gotta put in them reps, man. This is how I go. That's how I
And then
go.
on that, when you're writing new music, you said you sort of start out with the emotion of how you want the song, to represent how you're feeling or how, what the purpose of the song is. Is there anything else in that process you normally do? Do you do melody first? Do you do harmony first? Is it different every time?
My previous albums were pretty much just me at a piano. Almost every song I think I wrote like that. But now, like, I play guitar, produce more, so it's expanded the process. So, I wrote in B this one over a drum loop. It's like just a drum loop, and I came up with that ba da da, ba da da da, ba da da. Then I looped it, and then I just improvised over that. And recorded it, and the melody was somewhere in my phone. I was like, dang, that's fire. All right, I gotta read, go through 5 minute improv and find it. And I learned that technique from Marquis Hill, who says he writes just improvising like that too. So yeah, I've found new ways and techniques of creating and writing tunes that aren't just at the piano, because I was finding I was just writing a similar tempo a lot and a lot of and yeah, so that's helped to find different feels, different pockets, and different energy. And then also I'm collaborating more now. I'm out in LA and stuff, and I'm like doing more sessions with people, and that's been cool. And like collaborating in the writing process, because I haven't done much of that. Like you'll see even on this record, like Black Mona Lisa, Renfro helped me write the bridge. Meters, he helped me write the bridge and redo some of the chords. Like that's one of the first times I've ever done that. I normally write it all, and then I just let people kind of interpret the groove or whatever, like different things on the spot. Like oh yeah, you're hearing it here, like, or this voicing, like you do whatever voicings you want. But typically, yeah, no doubt somewhere between most of those records, I just wrote everything myself, and like these are the chords. This is a this. This is this. This is this. And then, like I said, the drummer will change shit and move things around. But this album, man, I work with Fro in some songs, and I was like, because there were some songs I just didn't know where it should go. Well, I wrote the A section, and I'm like, where should the bridge go? So he helped on that. And then this next record I'm working on this time around, even more collaboration. I'm even more like, yo, guys, like, what do you think about this section? Like, y'all want to write something here? Trying to be more collaborative with it, because what I've seen out in LA is like people make whole albums like that, which is really cool. You know what I mean? Just pull up the people's studio and we just all just make it together. You know what I'm saying? And like, even though everyone can play everyone's instrument, it's like whatever. It's like whatever makes the song, let's do it. So like, I've been inspired by that process, as opposed to I feel like in New York and in a lot of jazz scene, it's like, all right, here are the charts, read it, do it. That's cool, but I'm
And
trying to do something different.
no, I was just gonna say, I'm a big fan of hip hop and just like the Dreamville guys and knowing like the Revenge of the Dreamers, how they go in and create those albums, and it's just pure collaboration. They all get together for a couple weeks and whatever comes out. I think that's a really beautiful process, and having multiple people's ideas to bounce off of is really cool. I wanted to ask if like there were any artists you really wanted to like collaborate with in the future, like who would you want to work with?
Yeah, I was just thinking about Smino. That's gotta happen, bro. Her, Mariba, she's dope. Amara, she's fire. I would be down to play. Oh, Knower. So Lewis Cole, I gotta play with him one of these days. That would be sick, bro. Jam. Let's see, bro. Anderson .Paak. Yet to work with Anderson .Paak. That would be
That'd
so
be
sick.
awesome.
Yeah, I feel like if I get in there with like D Mile or something, maybe one of these sessions or something. Yeah, there might be a world where I make it. I could meet Andy or something. That'd be cool.
That'd be awesome. Yeah, Anderson .Paak. I love all of his stuff from, Malibu and the, No
Woo!
Worries stuff.
What a classic. The G's. Bro, Malibu is insane.
That's another one that just does, like, it's, just so many different elements of different kinds of music with R&B and so many different things. He's so good at that as well.
Yeah, he's insane. truly.
Yeah, so you gotta make that happen, and yeah, I would love to hear that.
I'm working on it. That would be awesome. Yeah, we shall see. We shall see.
Cool.
I got one question about it's my last one about the album. Could you speak to like self-releasing a record versus shopping around for a label? Have you experienced both? Do you prefer self-releasing? You know, what are the advantages or disadvantages of that?
Yeah, well, I'll just preface all this. Like, the industry is constantly changing to the point that, like, you know, even when I started, which is not that long ago, but like my first project was in 2013, the little EP, and my first album 2016. Yeah, so much has changed from just 2016. But I'll say this. I had a few options to sign, you know, early on, and I just didn't feel like they were very favorable at first. And I, you know, yeah, there was a bit of like, yeah, I was like touring with Christian. I was like, oh, I'm touring with Christian, you know? And then like, you get, then after a few years, I'm like, oh, I got my own music. I'd like to do my own thing. And then, yeah, the world hits you. I was like, oh yeah, duh. You had to still start from ground zero. You play great, maybe, you know, but you still, as far as like the industry or the record industry, or even the live touring side is concerned, they're like, we don't know your value in this space at all. And this is before, you know, social media was that crazy. So, or that popular, like, I don't know that many musicians going viral and all that at that point, like, you know, 2014 or 2013 yet. Cause I don't even know if Instagram was that big. So, yeah, the whole idea of like, you get your first record and maybe getting any sort of advance or any sort of recording budget, that was not even a thing. So my first couple label deals I was looking at were not that great. So I think by necessity, kind of like same thing, like right out of high school, where I was like, I don't see any good offers from any of these colleges. You know what I'm saying? As far as like, it was one of those again where it's like, okay, I got to get to work, you know, essentially. So I think kind of forced my hand to just be like, I'm going to self-release these. So my first record was out on CD Baby, and then the subsequent joints, I found a small label out of Portland that reached out to me, I should say, Fresh Select, and they put out Somewhere in Between, and then the remix record. And then I got out of that deal, and then I put out No Doubt, you know, independently. And then some other remixes and stuff, and then Fire Sign independently. And then, I forgot the Butcher Brown project was independent. And then kind of took all that data and then, you know, analytics that I had from TuneCore on that, and then revisited that label conversation years later, like 2023, whatever, you know what I mean? Or 2022. And yeah, Network kind of came right across my desk. You know, like, they literally emailed me. I had a homie of mine that used to work at Kobold, I think. Was it Kobold? No, AWOL. And she was over, Tara, shout out to Tara, she's over at Network. And she was like, yo, Brax, I'm trying to get you in there. I will connect you with the A&R. And then boom, you know, before I knew it, they sent me an offer like in like a couple of weeks. It was great. They've been nothing but great. Told you, George is the homie, man. George is awesome. Everyone over there is so, so dope, bro. So I'm grateful. I feel like I found a home that's like full of good people. They're nice. They're awesome. And it's like a perfect time in my life where I feel like I can really benefit from having a team. Cause before I just had more time, I feel like, to do all these things, you know, like hitting up podcasts and bloggers and stuff and following up online and doing all that. But yeah, with a kid and all this stuff going on now, I'm like, this is less time. So it makes sense for where I feel like where I'm at right now. And Network has been nothing but good for me for the past, you know, couple of years.
That's awesome. I think we're gonna wrap it up. I have a couple of closing questions. I just want to ask what we have to look forward from you in the rest of 2024. Any more projects, any more touring? And then where can our listeners go to support you and your work?
Sure. Yeah. So I got a whole other little mini project I did with my homie Phil Simmons. I don't know when that's coming out, but it's coming out at some point. And then I got another album that I'm really excited about, bro. Like, we getting there. The next project.
Cool.
Aiming to be done, like, with the music by like I want to say like August, be done with the music, you know what I'm saying? And then like start working on visuals, blah, blah, blah. And then yeah, we'll drop sometime next year, 2025. But like very, very excited about this next one. Because I got to record a lot of this like all in one room, as opposed to this last one took 3 years because I was like send emailing drum parts and all this stuff around. So like yeah, this if the energy of it feels like, oh, dope. Like we all got to like be in one room to make a lot of this. So I'm excited. So yeah, new music. And for the music that's already out, you know, you can go to my website and learn about really pretty much everything, BraxtonCook.com, tour dates, music, merch, all that. Also have a Patreon, so you can check out patreon.com/BraxtonCook, where you can get some behind the scenes footage, all that, plus like just information on music for mainly for musicians, you know. And then yeah, anywhere else you can stream music, you can
Cool.
probably find my music.
Cool. I
Cool.
had one question I want to ask you about the album coming up. Do you feel like it's similar to your most recent album, or, you know, can you give us any insight to kind of the inspiration behind the album, the, you know, the vibe of
Oh
the
yeah,
album?
no, not
Okay.
yet,
All right. All right.
not yet,
Yeah. I had to ask.
not yet. Still early days, man, but it's
Cool.
good.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm sure it's great. Well, yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. It's been awesome getting to hear your perspective, and we've really enjoyed getting to dive into the album. We're going to do an episode on the album and kind of break down, you know, the track by track. So super excited to get to talk to you about it. Yeah, it's been awesome. Thanks so much for taking the time, man.
My boys, Max and Dwayne, thank you, man.
Yeah, thanks,
Thank
Braxton.
you.
And good luck with
Yeah.
the rest of the project. We're super excited to hear it whenever it does come out. So good luck with that and to the family and everything. It's been awesome, man. Thank you so much.
Course, bro. Y'all have a good one, okay?
Awesome. Thanks, you too, Braxton. All right, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to that interview. It was really awesome to get to talk to Braxton. He gave us so much of his time and just really got deep into some answers. Cool to hear about his tour in Europe, to get to hear about, you know, his journey as a musician and why he decided to really devote himself to music, about his family, about his father, and, you know, the pressures that he felt to go to school and why he decided to do music. And then really just talk to him about the album, which seems just like a lot of the same of the questions we asked him about himself is what we were getting in the album. It really is an expression of himself. So it's a really great conversation. I definitely learned a lot from it. And yeah, it was super great. Max, do you have any closing thoughts on our interview?
None in particular, but there's some sort of concepts I gathered from our conversation with him. I mean, number one, he really is sort of just great at what he does, and he's always, it seems like he's sort of always interested in growing his ability and his musical language and what he, you know, how he, we talked about the creative process, how he writes music and how he's getting more collaborative, and you can get a sense that he's on this journey, and that an album in Braxton Cook's career or discography is a moment in his life where he is musically, in addition to where he is in the real world. And so he mentioned that. He said, "Who are you when no one is watching?" is like a snapshot among or sorry, a rather. Along the journey of Braxton Cook. And he talked about how different albums mean different things because they're at different times in his life, and he's trying to show emotion at different, you know, with different songs and at different moments. And so just the trajectory of an artist is really shown and emulated from Braxton Cook and what he does with his career.
Yeah, and I'm super looking forward to, you know, we got into his upcoming projects a little bit. He said he has an album coming out probably next year. I'm just super excited to see where he goes with that. I think that his albums are just so insightful and thoughtful, especially this album is just so reflective. So excited to kind of go on the journey with him, it feels like. And so it was awesome to meet him and looking forward to that for sure.
Right. I mean, it's just a great experience that we got to have and we can give our listeners. And I want to say, you know, to our audience, if there's maybe some other people you might want us to interview, feel free to reach out. and give us some ideas. And if you're an artist yourself, let us know. You know, we may be able to make something happen. Feel free to email us at the Jazz Jam Podcast. And somebody from Braxton's team reached out to us, and that's how we were able to get this together. So hopefully there's a lot more like this to come.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I hope so. It was super awesome kind of to get out of our comfort zone and do an interview. We hadn't done one yet, and to have Braxton on, he was super easy to work with, so super thankful for that. But yeah, I just want to say thank you, everyone, for listening. The album review that we're going to do of Who Are You When No One Is Watching is going to be upcoming in one of the next two episodes. So definitely look forward to that. We're going to be diving deep into this album and really, like we do every episode, really, you know, kind of getting into the music, the messages. So that'll be a fun one. And it's just awesome to be able to hear from Braxton first and then, you know, really get deep and dive into that album. So go check that out when it comes out. And just as well as, you know, go follow us on Instagram. We have a YouTube channel that we're putting a lot of stuff up on. We've got the video of the interview on there. So yeah, just go check all that stuff out. We'd love to hear from you as well. You can email us at thejazzjampodcast@gmail.com or submit a question through our website. And that's all in the link in the bio of this show. So thank you so much for supporting us. Thank you so much for listening. And it's been a great episode getting to talk to Braxton. And we'll catch you next time on the Jazz Jam Podcast. My sweet and chocolate lovey, I'll miss the way you love me. Just love me like the 90s, oh babe. Put your dreams to the side.